Knowledge Products presents Taxes and the IRS as part of a series of presentations on Secrets of the Great Investors, narrated by Louis Lucas.
It has been said by some historians that there are two kinds of people in this world. The first kind labor to produce the goods and services that satisfy their own basic needs, including food, shelter, and protection from life's adversities. Such people either produce what they need or exchange their excess produce for something that another person has produced in abundance. For example, a farmer may trade his abundance of corn for the fishmonger's abundance of fish, and both are better off than before. The second kind of people, as these historians see it, simply seize the goods and services they want from those who have produced them. Here, one person's advantage is another person's loss. For example, early societies often had wandering warriors who lived by preying on more peaceful tribes. Over time, these warriors took on different mantles, and they found ways to legitimize their theft. The German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer was one who divided people into these two categories, whose basic methods he described as the free market method and the political method of obtaining what we need.
There are two fundamentally opposed means whereby man, requiring sustenance, is impelled to obtain the necessary means for satisfying his desires. These are work and robbery. One's own labor and the forcible appropriation of the labor of others. I propose to call one's own labor and the equivalent exchange of one's own labor for the labor of others, the economic means for the satisfaction of needs, while the unrequited appropriation of the labor of others will be called the political means. The state is an organization of the political means. No state, therefore, can come into being until the economic means has created a definite number of objects for the satisfaction of needs, which objects may be taken away or appropriated by warlike robbery.
In a civilized society, if a person tries forcibly to take something of value from another, he is treated as a thief and is punished or forced to make restitution to his victim. However, government itself reserves the right to do what the individual cannot, forcibly to take the property of others. When the government does it, it's called taxation, and it's legal. There's an ongoing battle between the political and economic methods of transferring wealth. During the 20th century, both means have increased in size and power, although the various political means, taxes, regulation, and inflation, have grown faster. However, some economists believe the late 20th century may have seen a historic shift. The tearing down of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of Soviet communism have rejuvenated the economic means in Central and Eastern Europe. And in the Pacific Rim, some of the poorest island nations have used the economic means to become more prosperous than many nations in the industrial West. In these island countries, such as Japan, the government often provides support for the economic means instead of the other way around. The author Charles Adams has written about the so-called miracle economies of the Far East.
The uniqueness of Japan's phenomenal growth is now no longer unique. As for other Asian nations with even less national wealth, if any at all, have, like Japan, joined the Miracle Economy Club. Any nation could duplicate what they have achieved. These Asian miracle economies are Japan, Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore. They all learned that the proper role of government was to assist, advise, help, finance and do whatever it could to make private business prosper. They all avoided big government, excessive spending, and heavy or punitive taxation.
For more than a century, the U.S. followed this approach and prospered enormously over the long haul. A rising tide of productivity raised the living standards of everyone. However, the disparity between the most wealthy and the least wealthy was used by advocates of socialism and of the political means as a way to justify efforts to redistribute wealth through an income tax. Once the U.S. embarked on this course, it found, as many earlier nations had found, that burdening the economic means with more and more political means is a slippery slope leading to slower growth, if not actual decay. What follows is a very short recap of the highlights of the history of taxation in the U.S. It is a story that includes many battles between the apostles of the political means and the practitioners of the economic means, who were and are on the defensive against those who would seize and redistribute what others have earned. Gerald Carson, author of a book called The Golden Egg, has observed that throughout history, many people have been tempted to use political means to acquire property from those who produced it.
The rudiments of the income tax may be discerned in primitive societies, when public necessities such as the common defense began to be felt, and the chief of the clan or tribe was supported by gifts, either of service or property. These voluntary commitments were in time transformed into a legal obligation, and their performance was brutally enforced.
According to Carson, history shows that if taxation becomes excessive, with no opportunity for relief, it leads inevitably to revolt or flight from the nation. Carson cites an early example.
The first taxpayers' revolt known to history was recorded on three clay cones and an oval-shaped plaque excavated by the French in 1878 at the site of the Sumerian city-state in Mesopotamia called Lagash. In the third millennium B.C., the Lagashites threw out the reigning dynasty and installed a new and presumably less expensive ruler.
Charles Adams, author of the book For Good and Evil, tells us that oppressive taxes were common in ancient Egypt.
The tax story of ancient Egypt shows what happens in a society burdened with a totalitarian revenue system. The informer, the corrupt revenue official, and most significantly, the tyranny of an all-pervading surveillance are inherent in such a system. The Egyptians used the scribes to oversee the pharaoh's revenue system. The scribe was the substitute for the banking record, the computer, the tax identifying number, and the other devices of the modern tax gatherer. The scribes were everywhere, snooping, inspecting, and recording.
Carson says that brutal tax policies were the real reason behind the decline of the Roman Empire.
The privileges and exemptions enjoyed by the powerful classes, the oppressive burdens laid on the rest of the citizenry, the war-induced collapse of the currency, all weakened the will of the people to resist the barbarian incursions, and so contributed significantly to the decline and fall of Rome.
Early Western history is an ongoing story of conflict between various rulers trying to impose taxes and royal subjects struggling to throw off the yoke of taxes that became excessive. These conflicts contributed significantly to the evolution of English common law and led to ideas that influenced the framers of the U.S. Constitution. Charles Adams' book, entitled For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization, is a fountainhead of research and insight into this long conflict between tax collectors and taxpayers. Adams, who has degrees in history and philosophy and a doctorate in law, says a turning point occurred during the 15th century in what is now France.
Following the death of Charles the Bold, His daughter, Mary of Burgundy, was confronted with angry, overtaxed subjects on the verge of rebellion. To promote peace, she moderated taxes and promulgated a famous charter, like the Magna Carta, which was called the Great Privilege. It expanded the principles of Magna Carta. If any ruler violated the tax rights and liberties of the people would be relieved of their civic duties to the state. In other words, the people now had the right of divorce, and the state had lost its right to rule.
Adams notes also that in England after the Magna Carta, a division of power between Parliament and King helped to restrain the government's urge to tax and spend.
The tax system enacted after the Magna Carta was directed, when it worked, by frugal and incorruptible parliamentarians who checked the appetites of many of England's kings. In this remarkable system, the power to tax was separated from the power to spend. The king could spend but could not tax. The parliament could tax but not spend.
Adams also sheds new light on the legends of Lady Godiva and William Tell.
In the legend of Lady Godiva, the Countess Godiva appealed to her husband to remit the heavy taxes he imposed on the town of Coventry in central England. Fed up with her nagging, he promised to comply if she rode nude through the town. She let her hair down, so only her beautiful legs showed, mounted a horse, and rode through the town. The taxes were remitted. Today, Godiva's ride is reenacted in pageants in Coventry. In 1273, the powerful Habsburg family in Austria refused to recognize the independence of the Swiss and sent in tax gatherers and overlords to collect full feudal dues. The Swiss were not willing to submit to full Habsburg taxation, and rebellion followed. William Tell refused to acknowledge the Austrian Habsburgs and their gang of tax collectors. For this defiance, he was ordered to shoot an apple from the head of his son with a crossbow. The admiration and homage the Swiss have for the legendary William Tell are not for his skill with a crossbow, but for igniting a successful revolt against the oppressive tax policies of King Rudolf of Habsburg and his successors.
In the late 20th century, Switzerland has remained the only European country not burdened with excessive taxes and deficit spending. The chief reason is that Swiss citizens must approve any changes in government spending, and they must approve by referendum the taxes needed to support those expenditures. Many people seem to believe that the income tax is an American invention. However, in the early 1800s, the British adopted a flat-rate income tax to pay for the Napoleonic Wars. According to Gerald Carson,
the rate was 10%, proportional, not graduated, with a graziosa feature which excluded from the levy the first 60 pounds of income. Repealed in 1802, the tax was reimposed in 1803 when the war broke out again.
England's income tax was repealed again in 1816, then reinstated in 1842, as described by Carson.
In 1842, Sir Robert Peel's ministry, moving away from heavy indirect taxation and toward free trade, reinstated the tax. For three quarters of a century, the British income tax existed as a so-called temporary measure. Gladstone, at last, in 1880, conceded that it was permanent.
Many Americans recognize England as the primary source for U.S. laws, language, and culture. Yet Americans also have adopted many of England's tax policies. Nearly every school child learns about the Boston Tea Party, a tax protest that precipitated the revolt of the colonies against England. According to the author and historian Shelley Davis,
the infamous Boston Tea Party prompted Parliament to enact even more punitive measures against the rebellious colonists. thus sealing their spirit of armed opposition to foreign domination and unwanted taxation.
Most Americans have been taught that the colonies revolted against England mostly out of a desire for freedom. But it seems to have been forgotten that much of the dispute was about freedom from excessive taxes and abusive tax collectors. Charles Adams points out that many of England's subjects, including those within England itself, were chafing against their burdens.
When the American colonists were complaining about being denied the rights of Englishmen, the English at home had the same complaint. The great majority of excise tax cases were tried summarily, without a jury or even an independent judge, often before the very tax commissioners who collected the tax. But if the American revolutionists in 1776 had studied their Dutch history, they would have realized that taxation with representation does not necessarily lessen the tax burden.
Part of the background behind America's revolt involves the power of the British customs officers to search for smuggled goods by using a legal device called a writ of assistance. This gave British revenue agents the authority to engage in a search without a court order. Although it was not used extensively, Adams explains that the potential for abuse inspired America's founding fathers to write the Constitution's Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures.
The writ of assistance is important in American history because the threat of its use caused the founding fathers to place the great Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights. Although that great amendment is not now used to restrain revenue agents, it was initially adopted to do just that.
After the Revolution, the Confederation of States had no power to obtain the tax revenue to pay for the expenses of the Revolutionary War. Basically, the Confederation had to rely on voluntary financial support from the various colonies, much as the United Nations now relies on voluntary support from its members. The weakness of America's colonial government, and of today's United Nations, shows how clearly political power is associated with the power to tax. In the fledgling colonies, there was tremendous pressure to form a more cohesive union. As Gerald Carson observes,
the authority to tax is necessarily coupled with the power to coerce. Reluctant and apprehensive taxpayers often remind us of Chief Justice John Marshall's ominous words, "The power to tax invokes the power to destroy." Yet a government lacking this power, which goes to the heart of sovereignty, cannot long endure. This explains the sense of urgency that spurred the delegates to the Constitutional Convention to produce a framework of a genuine federal union in which the taxing power was central to all other powers.
The structure of America's representative democracy, with a carefully designed separation of powers between Congress, the President, and the courts, was a compromise between a desire for stronger national government and a desire to protect citizens from the well-known tendency of government to impose burdensome taxes. In particular, the new nation was desperate for revenue to pay off the expenses of the Revolutionary War, and the Federalists were imposing an assortment of taxes to put the new nation on a sound financial footing. However, having just fought a war of independence over tax issues, the voters were not inclined to be overly concerned about the fiscal fitness of their new federal government. According to historian Shelley Davis,
in the election of 1800, the Jeffersonian Democrats voted the two tax-happy team of Federalists out of the White House, mainly on the strength of candidate Jefferson's solemn vow to cut taxes.
From the beginning of the 19th century until the Civil War, U.S. government revenues came primarily from customs duties and proceeds from the sale of federal lands. Except for the expenses of the War of 1812, the new government had little need for large amounts of revenue. The peaceful growth of the United States was jarred by the Civil War. And Charles Adams maintains that this national rupture was primarily due to a conflict over excise taxes.
One of the most popular myths in American history is that the Civil War was started over slavery. During his campaign for the presidency in 1860, Lincoln repeated time and again that he would not interfere with slavery in the South. There had been a prolonged struggle between the rich planters of the South and the rich industrialists of the North, and it was not over slavery. Secession by the South was a reaction against Lincoln's high tax policy. In 1861, the slave issue was not critical. Lincoln and the Congress gave unequivocal assurance that slavery in the South would be respected. Yet the South would not budge from its secessionist plans.
To help pay for the cost of the war, Lincoln pushed through the first income tax in the United States. There was no challenge to the constitutionality of the tax because the country was at war. Former IRS historian Shelley Davis describes the impact of that income tax.
Our present-day income tax is one of the lasting legacies of the Civil War. In 1862, in the heat of the conflict, President Lincoln established the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the direct predecessor of today's IRS. The Civil War tax on income was shockingly progressive, exempting the first $600 in income and taxing income between $600 and $10,000 at the comfortable rate of 3%. Incomes above $10,000, enjoyed by only a handful of our most fortunate citizens, were taxed at a rate of 5%. An 1869 editorial in the New York Tribune denounced the income tax as the most odious, vexatious, inquisitorial, and unequal of all our taxes.
Despite this brief experience with a progressive income tax, most of the 19th century was a period of very limited government, respect for property rights, and negligible taxes. It was a century of great growth and comparative prosperity. In essence, the United States went through three generations without the oppressive weight of a government with unbridled taxing powers. Given people's tendency to assume that current conditions will continue forever, there was a general lack of concern over the power of government. And most Americans seemed to believe that the U.S. Supreme Court could never agree to let the federal government expand its powers. The Civil War era income tax was a temporary measure, scheduled to expire in 1870. Still, as Carson notes, Americans widely evaded the tax after the war.
After the surrender at Appomattox, when patriotic fervor had subsided and government finances were improving, cordial feelings toward the income tax evaporated. Evasion of the tax was widespread.
Congress had no appetite to continue the unpopular income tax, and it was allowed to expire. The government resorted again to reliance on customs duties, an assortment of excise taxes, and proceeds from the sale of federal lands. But some Americans were persuaded that the wealthy had gotten that way by being creditors, depriving the poor of their fair share of the prosperity. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, envy and resentment were expressed in the populist movement. It reached such proportions that the Constitution ultimately was amended to allow new taxes to be imposed on the rich. According to Davis,
by the Gilded Age of the 1890s, populists saw a soak-the-rich income tax as the ideal way to redistribute wealth from the grossly rich to the pathetically poor. During the financial panic of 1893, Democrat Grover Cleveland in the White House and Democratic majorities in both House and Senate threatened to join forces to push through a new income tax. The new tax would strike only the really rich, that 1% of the population with household incomes over $4,000. The populist faction won overwhelmingly, passing the 1894 Wilson Tariff Act, a bill Grover Cleveland grudgingly allowed into law without signing it.
The Wilson Tariff Act was primarily a long list of excise taxes, but it included an income tax as well. The income tax rate was extremely modest by more recent standards. However, despite constitutional prohibitions against laws that were not applied uniformly, the tax was targeted only toward the wealthy. Moreover, the law represented a precedent whereby Congress could expand the tax without the consent of the taxpayers. Wealthy Americans challenged the tax on constitutional grounds, claiming that it violated the Constitution's apportionment clause. In 1895, the Supreme Court found the new tax to be unconstitutional, as Carson explains.
On May 8, 1895, the court declared the whole law unconstitutional by the barest of margins, 5-4, one justice having changed his opinion. The decision left the matter in this position. The income tax was a direct tax and could not be levied except on a basis proportional to the population of each state. Some 48,672 individuals had already paid their income taxes, amounting to more than $6 million, when the court decided the whole law was null and void. All income tax work stopped, and the income tax division disbanded on June 30, 1895.
Nevertheless, pressures for more active forms of government were advancing throughout the industrial world. The theories espoused by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in their 1848 work, The Communist Manifesto, had received a half century of attention from those who espoused the political means over the economic means. Vladimir Lenin adopted Marxist theories to foster a successful but bloody revolution in Russia in 1917. Many American reformers were affirming communist and socialist ideals. They had not yet recognized the brutal reality of totalitarian socialism. Reformers focused intensely on the great disparity of wealth in the United States, and Adams explains how this led to an amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
The advocates for income taxation pushed the 16th Amendment through the state legislatures, giving Congress the power to tax income without apportionment. The new amendment succeeded because of assurances the rates would never exceed a few percentage points.
Many opponents of the amendment were optimistic that a direct federal income tax would never be ratified by the states, but it was quickly approved by the required three-fourths of the states. On February 3, 1913, Wyoming became the 36th state to ratify the 16th Amendment. The first post-amendment income tax law was passed so quickly that it was not even set forth in a separate bill. The tax was included as part of the Underwood-Simmons Tariff Act. Section 2 set the rate of excise tax on hundreds of items such as bauxite, gloves, and wild animals, and retroactively imposed an income tax beginning in March 1913, 7 months before the law was passed in October 1913. Charles Adams notes that although the new income tax law was quickly challenged on constitutional grounds,
the court disposed of the question with not much more than a one-liner.
As the 16th Amendment was being pushed through the ratification process in state legislatures, many political leaders had been concerned that the U.S. was about to be dragged into a European war. As Gerald Carson points out,
any thoughtful reader searching for a rationale to explain the extraordinary vitality of the income tax can easily find it in one word: war.
Indeed, war has always been a primary reason for imposing higher taxes. And World War I resulted in the rapid escalation of tax rates under the new income tax system. According to Charles Adams,
the first income tax law had a 7% maximum rate, which was changed to 15% in 1916. In 1917, it jumped to 67%, then 77%. When these ultra-high rates hit, high incomes quickly began to disappear, as if by magic. the Treasury reported $206 million incomes in 1916, when the top tax rate was 7%. In 1921, when the top tax rate was 77%, only $21 million incomes were reported.
The so-called War to End All Wars ended on November 11, 1918. In its aftermath came an economic boom and a brief period of relative peace and prosperity. Shelley Davis comments on the status of the income tax at the beginning of the tumultuous 1920s.
By the dawn of the Roaring Twenties, the income tax had become the federal government's main source of income. The income tax still remained strikingly progressive. The rich, who a decade before had paid hardly any taxes at all, were now, to their chagrin, shouldering the lion's share of the burden. But once marginal rates soared to the 70% level, the rich began aggressively sheltering income into tax-exempt state and local bonds, while furtively shifting assets into personal holding companies taxed at the lower corporate rate. The result was that revenues dropped, even as rates soared.
The well-to-do were joined by the rapidly growing middle class in swinging the popular vote back to the fiscally conservative Republicans. The populists and the Democrats had promoted the 16th Amendment with promises that the top tax rate would never exceed 10%, and that the income tax would apply only to the most wealthy citizens. Unprepared for the political backlash, and now without a war to persuade the populace to go along with high tax rates, the populists and Democrats lost the 1920 elections, and the Republicans quickly reduced the top tax rates. Secretary of the Treasury Andrew Mellon was an early practitioner of what has now become known as supply-side economics. According to Shelley Davis,
having keenly observed that railroad freight rates were traditionally set at a level known as what the traffic will bear, Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon sharply cut tax rates 3 times in 10 years. As a result, overall revenues, in fact, rose.
This early experience illustrates the important difference between tax revenues and tax rates. To this day, many observers speak of raising taxes or lowering taxes as if tax revenues always rise or fall in proportion to tax rates. Andrew Mellon showed early on that reduced tax rates can produce more tax revenue, perhaps by reducing tax avoidance or evasion, and more significantly by encouraging earners to produce more income, and therefore more income tax revenues. In a similar vein, Mellon rewarded investors by pushing through a reduced tax rate of 12.5% on capital gains income, which previously had been taxed like any other income. Many believe that the Great Depression was caused by the stock market crash of 1929, after a decade of exuberant speculation and rising consumer debts. While speculation and debt levels might have triggered the crash and the ensuing recession, these factors really don't explain the prolonged lack of business recovery during the 1930s. One plausible explanation blames misguided government tax policies. Republican President Herbert Hoover was strongly opposed to federal budget deficits. During the early years of the Great Depression, he insisted on raising tax rates instead of reducing them. In her book, Unbridled Power, Shelley Davis observes,
after Black Friday, 1929, Herbert Hoover pressed Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon to boost tax rates in a desperate attempt to plug a growing deficit. The results were predictable. The economy's already escalating collapse turned into a total freefall.
Gerald Carson explains how the federal government proceeded to pour gasoline on the fiscal fires in 1932.
With the appearance of huge Treasury deficits during the Depression years, the rates were again stepped up for the first time since 1918. The Revenue Act of 1932 also broadened the tax base and lowered the exemptions.
Franklin Roosevelt responded to cries for government to do something with promises of a New Deal. He assumed his duties as president in 1933. But instead of reversing Hoover's tax policy, he raised tax rates once again on the wealthy. As before, the rich found many legal ways to divest themselves of income that would be subject to the new income taxes. Some shifted investments into tax-exempt state and municipal bonds, while others shifted assets into a variety of trusts. Some simply moved their money offshore into secret accounts in Switzerland or other tax haven countries. To stem this flood tide of tax avoidance, Roosevelt tried to close some of the loopholes used by the wealthy. Gerald Carson observes,
President Roosevelt sent a message to Congress on June 1, 1937, about the need for further revisions in the law to deal with such tax schemes as personal holding companies, family partnerships, multiple trusts for relatives, and the yacht and country home gambit. Congress responded promptly with the Revenue Act of 1937. A goodly number of loopholes were closed.
The wealthy had little incentive to invest in business ventures, which might have restored the economy's health more quickly. It might be said that the abstinence of the wealthy did cause the longest depression in U.S. history, but it's important to recognize the demotivating role of U.S. tax policies. We might say that informally, many of America's leading capitalists simply went on strike. The Second World War stimulated America's lagging economy. It also stimulated Congress to impose much higher tax rates, allow many fewer exemptions, and significantly boost the number of Americans required to pay income taxes. Before the war, less than 5% of Americans paid income tax. By war's end, nearly everyone did so. Almost every year during the war, a new tax law was passed, each time raising tax rates and taxing a larger range of incomes. According to Gerald Carson,
the Revenue Act of 1941 lowered exemptions once more, boosting surtax rates to curb war profiteering and inflation and to help pay for the national mobilization. New millions of Americans felt for the first time the weight of income taxation. War and taxation, as always, being bonded together, and receipts always falling behind expenditures. The Revenue Act of 1942 produced 36.5 million personal tax returns, of which 27.7 million reported on the bottom line money owing to the government. Yet the Treasury was so pressed for money that the act was inadequate before it was passed.
The most significant change in U.S. tax law during World War II involved the payroll withholding tax. Taxes now would be deducted before Americans received their paychecks. Taxpayers had been accustomed to paying their income taxes in quarterly installments during the year after the income was earned. Writing these checks had been a constant reminder of how much the government was taking. Richard Good observes how withholding in America has been associated specifically with income taxes.
The enforcement of the income tax has been greatly aided by withholding of tax on wages and salaries. Withholding could be extended to dividends, interest, and certain other periodic income payments, as in many countries. But Congress has rejected proposals for doing so.
Historian Shelley Davis has noted that during World War II, annual federal tax revenue increased nearly sevenfold, from $7 billion in 1941 to $45 billion by 1945. At the war's end, the incomes of more than 50 million Americans were subject to income tax withholding. Unlike the income tax imposed during the Civil War, the income tax did not die a peaceful death after the end of World War II in 1945. Courts had deemed the income tax to be constitutional because of the 16th Amendment. The tax base had been greatly expanded during the Second World War. Additionally, the practice of withholding made most taxpayers less aware of the full amount they were paying. After the war, Americans fed their large pent-up demand for housing, cars, and other amenities that had been so scarce during the Depression and war. America's population also was exploding in a baby boom. All of this created an economic expansion that produced another rising tide of income, providing more for everyone, including government. According to Gerald Carson,
the revenue yield after World War II was determined principally by the result of two forces: the rate fixed for the first bracket and the level allowed for personal exemptions. An adjustment up or down of only $100 in exempt income was sufficient to move billions of dollars into or out of the Treasury. The income tax was the most productive, it was found, when it reached the largest areas of income, not the largest incomes. For the lower income taxpayers, taken collectively, had the most money. From 1940 to 1945, the number of returns rose by more than 350%, while the population grew only 6%.
The income tax was now an entrenched part of America's political and economic structure. A tax that earlier generations had regarded as the epitome of socialism was now an accepted fact of life in the United States.
This is the end of Sidewalk. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.